Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Char. On this week's podcast, a 10-10 vision for the future. Could you reduce your carbon emissions by 10% during 2010?
I'm actually extremely excited and happy to realise that our generation has this immense responsibility, because everybody who came before us didn't know. And everybody who follows us, it'll be too late for them to do anything. So it is down to us.
As The Guardian launches one of the biggest ever mass participation campaigns to get people to do their bit for climate change, we ask whether putting the focus on individuals is the right approach.
The biggest problem is not our personal use of energy. The biggest problem is how we run our cities, how we run our agricultural systems, how we run our transportation and power grids.
We get the thoughts of NASA climate scientist and prolific blogger Gavin Schmidt. And can the project in the UK create ripples across the globe? We speak to our environment correspondent in China.
Britons would have to cut their carbon emissions by more than 60% just to get down to the level that Chinese people are already at.
It's time to face up to the challenge. This is a Science Weekly special from The Guardian. Well, it's called 10-10, a campaign to get individuals and companies to reduce their carbon footprints by 10% by the end of 2010. It's simple. Stop wasting energy. Cut down on unnecessary journeys. And while you're at it, save yourself some money too. As well as a direct effect on the environment, the campaign wants to influence the political debate too, by putting the pressure on the UK government ahead of the UN climate talks in Copenhagen this year. Among the organisations that have already signed up are Tottenham Hotspur Football Club, the Tate Modern, several hospitals and schools, and a host of celebs, including Rory Bremner, Anthony Gormley, and the Radio 1 DJ Sarah Cox. The project is being supported by Comic Relief and The Guardian, but 10-10 is the brainchild of Franny Armstrong, director of the much-acclaimed film on climate change, Age of Stupid. She dropped in to tell us how she came up with the idea.
To commit the UK to 10% is really major, you know. We've got big team of researchers working out exactly what would need to happen, which isn't impossible, you know, compared to a similar scale problem like the Second World War or something. You know, it's a war effort that's needed. It's not a couple of little tweaks. It's, you know, it's big stuff, but it is possible. But we do need to get, you know, the critical mass of people first in order to give the government the political space to make those changes.
What are the things that people can do? If I signed up for it, and then how would I interact with this project then?
Well, the good news is that the first 10% cut is actually very easy. It's the low-hanging fruit. It's the changing your light bulbs, turning down your heating, driving a bit less, flying a bit less, perhaps changing your eating habits a little bit. It's that kind of thing. Unless you're one of those people who've already started, in which case it's a lot harder. But it only gets really hard around 30 or 40%. So the first 10% anybody can do, it's very easy.
That just involves, as you said, the simple things that we should all have been doing anyway.
Perhaps in the 80s is the time we should have started doing this, yeah. But we are where we are. Yeah. And it's never too late to start.
Do you know what your own carbon footprint is?
Well, the thing about my carbon footprint is it was really, really good because I've been vegetarian since I was 11. I've never had a car. I live in a very cold house. I've got solar panels. I've got amazing insulation. I hate shopping, so I never buy anything. So I was doing really, really well until I made this climate blockbuster movie, and I'm now flying quite a lot to promote it. Like, we've just been in Australia last week and I'm going to America next week. So my carbon footprint has dramatically gone up since I've become such a successful climate campaigner, paradoxically.
What is your guiltiest green secret?
Well, my guiltiest green secret is probably the 96 tonnes of carbon dioxide that we emitted to make the film, The Age of Stupid, which, you know, that's equivalent to 4 Americans, 8 British people, about, I think it's, I don't know, 96 patio heaters for 1 month. So, you know, when we were making it, there was a lot of decisions. For example, I don't know if you've seen the film, but at the end, there's this great shot of this old guy mountain climbing that was clearly shot from a helicopter. It was shot from a helicopter because I shot it. And that kind of decision we had to make, like, you know, if we increase the production value of the film, we make it that much more mainstream by, you know, doing things like helicopter shots. Is that going to then be worth the emissions, the extra emissions or not?
But do you think there's an argument for activists, campaigners and so on to emit more carbon dioxide because what they're doing hopefully will bring awareness to an audience that might then hopefully reduce their own carbon emissions in total? Is there an argument for that?
There is definitely an argument for that. And, you know, everybody likes to pick on Al Gore because I think he took, was it 1,000 flights promoting Inconvenient Truth? But, you know, Al Gore did perhaps more than anybody has ever done in terms of raising climate change awareness. I mean, I don't know if he's number one, but he's certainly top 10 So that I would say that those are the best 1,000 flights that have ever been taken. I mean, if you consider every plane that he was on, there would be one Al Gore and 200 other people going on holiday. So I'd say let's stop the 200 holiday ones first before we start stopping Al Gore.
How are you going to judge whether 1010 is a success? What's your criteria at the end of the year?
Well, no country has ever deliberately cut its emissions. You know, some countries have cut their emissions, like when Britain went from coal to gas, we cut our emissions. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, they cut their emissions. But no country's ever gone, come on, let's start consuming less. And with a specific aim to cut their emissions to try and, you know, prevent climate change. So if we did that, that would be a triumph. If we did 1%, that would be a triumph. But unfortunately, 1% is nothing like what is needed for the ultimate aim of this whole thing, which is to prevent runaway climate change, clearly. So in those terms, it's really a win-lose situation, meaning either we keep this planet habitable for human life or we don't. So even though we would be like, yeah, we cut 4%, we'd be really, really happy on one level. On the other level, we'd be like, oh, but we are still committed to catastrophic climate change. So really, for me, success would only be changing the outcome at Copenhagen and getting the international deal that's as strong as the science demands, which is a pretty unlikely goal, I have to admit.
Are you optimistic, though?
Well, when I was making the film, I was just finishing it this time last year, like August last year, and there was a sequence in there about George Bush and how the White House is run by oil men and all the rest of it. And then we realised, oh, Bush is going to be out, you know, and we were thinking, should we take out this sequence or not? And then we were thinking, no, we won't take it out, because in the history of climate change, that's going to be a very important moment. And anyway, but if you watch the film now and you see that only last October we had an oil man in the government, and now we've got Obama who is saying, he's saying stuff that 2 years ago only environmental campaigners were saying, and now the president of the USA is saying it. So things are changing very, very fast. And other generations did manage to do what they had to do, meaning overturn slavery or end apartheid or even land on the moon. And there's no doubt that climate change is what our generation has to do. And I think more and more people are realising that. And this is what's been very interesting about 1010, because I've been involved in a lot of things in my life, but I've never been involved in something where whoever you speak to, whether it's the editor of a national newspaper or an energy company or a climate activist or a football club, whoever you speak to and says, this is the idea, do you want to get involved, says yes.
That was the filmmaker and 1010 founder, Franny Armstrong. Let's have a look at this in some more detail now. The Guardian's James Randerson and Adam Vaughan have been both deeply involved with this campaign, or at least launching it. James, Adam, welcome.
Hi.
Hello.
How you doing?
Okay, so James, do you want to take me through really quickly, how will this work? If you sign up to 1010 on September the 1st or on the website, what do you have to do?
Well, on one level, it's very simple. You just make a pledge, make a commitment to cut your carbon emissions by 10% by the end of 2010. And this applies to individuals, organisations, companies, anyone really who is prepared to make that commitment. I mean, it's easier for individuals typically, because there's a lot of low-hanging fruit there in terms of badly insulated houses, things like that. I mean, just lagging your loft will save you 10% and will also pay you back in probably about 2 years. The methodology for the campaign is slightly different and a bit more complicated for companies, because with companies, some have already made, you know, large cuts off their own back, and it becomes much harder for them to make more cuts. And also it depends on whether the company is sort of growing or contracting. And, you know, so if you're in a small, rapidly growing company, it's very difficult for you to cut your carbon emissions. And it would seem a bit unfair to say, well, you can't be part of 1010 because you're being successful as a business. So the details for companies are a little bit different. But you know, the idea is fairly simple, 10% by the end of 2010.
So Adam, what other things apart from lagging lofts can householders do?
Well, this is real classic top 10 green living list stuff. So, you know, real basics, turning stuff off standby. You know, apparently 10% of our electricity bills are wasted on just, you know, those little red lights and blinking clocks. So switch those off. Old-fashioned stuff like switching from incandescent light bulbs to modern alternatives like compact fluorescents. And
from today, you can't buy incandescents anymore in Europe anyway.
Exactly. Well, LEDs and CFLs are going to be the way forwards there. Eco-driving's another one. So, you know, you don't necessarily need to switch to a fancy hybrid car, you could just get a bit better at when you change gear and braking a bit more smoothly.
This is the hypermiling idea, isn't it?
So this is the hypermiling idea.
You drive more gently.
It is. It's a very geeky pursuit, but it's quite a fun challenge to do, and you can get quite competitive with your mates about it, see how many miles per gallon you can get out of your car.
What's the number 10? Why is that significant, James?
I mean, partly it alliterates nicely, but the sort of serious point to this is that we talk a lot about these kind of long-term targets of 80% cut by 2050, and basically that number comes from trying to get the world to converge on a per capita carbon emission of 2 tons per person, which is, you know, much less than what the UK is at the moment. For example, that it's about 11 tons per person.
Do you just keep these numbers in your head?
I do, yeah. They're all stored away there.
They're not written down in front of them, listeners, by the way.
And that, you know, that calculation takes into the fact that the population is going to increase from 6 billion-ish now to 9 billion-ish in 2050. But the trouble with those long-term targets is it means that apart from anything, it's rather intangible. You know, you can sort of think, well, we can put that off. We can keep increasing for the time being, and then, you know, suddenly some brilliant technology will come along, and we can, you know, that will allow us to cut our emissions much quicker. The fact is that if you cut them now, it's actually much less expensive in terms of, you know, what you have to do later, both in terms of how much you have to cut and in terms of adaptation, because, you know, more is going to, you know, there's going to be a bigger effect on the climate, which means more adaptation. So it's all about trying to make tangible cuts early on and to start the process going. And, you know, it's an achievable goal, and it's also meaningful. It's not sort of it's not a massive target that is impossible for people to meet, but equally it's not trivial. You know, it's not sort of 2 or 3% cut for an individual would be kind of in the noise of what they do in their daily lives, to be honest. So 10% is challenging but not unachievable.
I think also 10% is an interesting number because, as Adam said, you can do this with very simple things. The stuff that we've been going on about for ages, the stuff that isn't very sexy, replacing light bulbs, roof insulation, all this hypermiling stuff, but actually, if you want to do the 10% and you've given yourself a target and you've signed up for something and you can see this mass collaboration of things, and you can see that lots of people are doing it, it kind of helps. And you actually get around to doing the things you would have done if you just could be bothered. And also, if you try for 10%, I think you just end up doing more. If you try for 10%, if you replace all your light bulbs like I did in my house, you end up cutting more than 10% out of your emissions. And once you do that, you think, well, actually, you can get probably 20 or 30 very, very easily.
I think the good thing as well is it's kind of doable number for the 61 million people who live in the UK, rather than just the 5% of greenies who are very dedicated to this. I mean, anyone can achieve 10%.
One of the most significant things about this campaign is that it takes away a certain sense of powerlessness about climate change because, you know, it's easy to get very fatalistic about this because, you know, the fact is that individuals on their own can't really make any difference. I mean, you know, it's very easy to look cynically at people who are saying to you, well, you should change your light bulbs because, you know, the amount of difference that you'll make to the UK's carbon emissions is absolutely minuscule. And the UK's carbon emissions are only 2% of the world's carbon emissions anyway. And as people always say, you know, China is putting up a new coal-fired power station every week. You know, in the face of all that, it's so easy to think, well, you know, why should I bother? Why should I make the effort and change my lifestyle? However, if you're part of a big movement and you feel like your actions are somehow multiplied by all of these people, you know, I mean, it's an amazing list that they've got together from all sectors of civil society.
Well, let's look at that list, actually. I'm assuming that all three of us here are signed up or will be signed up soon.
Absolutely.
I reckon it's going to be quite hard for Adam because I think he lives very green anyway, so your 10% is going to be tough, mate. But anyway, the celebs on board, I mentioned Rory Bremner, Anthony Gormley, Sarah Cox. I mean, who else is on board?
It's got Delia Smith. that's enough to make me sign up. Come on, I love Delia.
She uses an oven a lot as well.
She is, and I highly recommend her vegetarian recipes book as well, which is another obviously good way of cutting your carbon footprint.
By being vegetarian, yes.
Yeah, so there's Delia, there's Spurs, which is obviously bad for Arsenal fans. There's Tate Modern.
Hopefully Arsenal will join up because of it.
Well, we'd like Arsenal to join as well, obviously. Yeah, there's Ian McEwan, there's the RSA, so there's lots of figures, cultural figures, as well as you know, people you see on your telly as well.
Significantly also, there are three energy companies have signed up, including E.ON, and their part in the campaign is that they're going to help people to sort of monitor how much they're cutting by stamping their bills to show, you know, how their bill in, say, March compared with their bill last year. So it gives you a kind of...
an actual number.
Exactly. So, because it is quite, you know, you can do these things and then not really work out, well, did it make any difference or not? And you'll be able to see on your electricity bill.
I mean, all these people, all these companies and people that we're talking about, the profiles are in G2 today, Tuesday the 1st of September, and there are reasons that they give for joining up. And interestingly, the people I've been speaking to, for example, Spurs, what they're interested in is getting their communities involved, not just them. Their stadium's obviously something they're looking at to reduce the energy use of that and everything, but they want to use their brand or their name essentially to get all of their fans on board, which is another 200,000 people in the vicinity who are living in old Victorian homes, who could be lugging their lofts and all of this, which is I think quite a nice thing, and hopefully some of their footballers are going to get involved too.
Which I think it's fair to say is also one of the main reasons the Guardian's involved, because obviously we've got a great community of readers.
Well,
let's talk a bit
about that actually. I mean, Alan Rusbridger did send a very interesting email around the other day about why the Guardian is involved. I mean, this is not our campaign, but we're launching the thing with a massive issue of G2 with all of this. There's going to be, I'm assuming, lots of stuff on the website for the next year. We're going to be following Tottenham Hotspur for a year. We're going to be following Tate Modern for a year, you know, as they do these things. So this is quite a commitment from us as well.
So, I mean, as obviously the Guardian's got its own sort of carbon reduction targets as a company, but I mean, Rusbridger and other people have already said before that the kind of biggest influence we can have is on our readership. So it's, you know, you the people out there, and we'll be kind of inviting everyone to come onto our site, the Guardian Environment site, and we're going to have carbon clinics. So we'll have kind of, you can jump in the blog and ask whatever question you've got. If you want to know, have a specific question about insulation or energy saving products, and you can jump in there, we'll have experts on hand to answer. We'll also be encouraging you to pledge on the site. There'll be a place to, so you can have a sort of public message of what you're going to do. So, you know, I think that's going to be one of the great ways is seeing Guardian readers and users picking this up and seeing how they interpret it.
And we'd also like people to send in their photographs. Part of the signing up is that you get a piece of aluminium from a dead plane.
Piece of aluminium? It's more than that.
It's better than that. Yeah, yeah. No, it's not just any old piece of aluminium that was previously going flying around in the stratosphere, kind of contributing to the problem. It's now made into the rather snazzy 1010 logo. So it's a bit like the kind of Make Poverty History band. It's a sort of way of saying, I'm involved, I'm part of this campaign.
Guys, how are we going to judge whether this is a success? I mean, I asked Franny at the end, and she was talking about whether this has any impact on Copenhagen. Because the idea of this is to get lots of people signed up before Copenhagen, which is in December, so not very long. And then that allows our ministers in Copenhagen to say, look, we've got an entire public that are willing to sort of cut their emissions by 10% in 2010. So let's push for a harder deal. What's a success in your eyes?
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, Ed Miliband sort of back in April said that he wants a Make Poverty History style campaign on climate change to help him get a deal at Copenhagen. And hopefully this will be it. I mean, it's really hard to say at the moment because it's just starting. But, you know, judging from the people who are behind it, I think it stands a really good chance. And I think it's really going to depend on the momentum and how many people sign up. But, you know, numbers are important.
Yeah, I think it's a really powerful meme. You know, I hope people take it up and it does, you know. I mean, there is definitely, even at launch, there is a real cross-section of society involved. And, you know, hopefully that can kind of snowball. And, I mean, you know, Franny obviously wants to ask Ed Miliband to commit the UK to a 10% cut in 2010. I mean, that, let's make no bones about it, that is very, very tough. To do 10% in a year for the UK is, you know, really, really difficult. And particularly if next year, you know, the economy starts to pick up and things start growing again, I mean, there would be some very, very tough political choices. And I'm not really sure whether he's prepared to make those. But I mean, in terms of a civil society movement that says, like, okay, you wanted a Make Poverty History campaign, you've got one, now go to Copenhagen and push for a better deal. I mean, that's important. But I mean, you know, at the end of the day, the big players there are obviously, you know, the US and China.
Well, we'll talk a bit about China a bit later. For more information on all this, there's everything you want to know at guardian.co.uk/environment, or you can go to 1010uk.org.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
He's a climate modeller at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York. In 2004, he was named one of Scientific American's top 50 research leaders. He's the founding member and one of the contributors to the realclimate.org blog. And he's been visiting The Guardian's London studios. Gavin Schmidt has been speaking to James Randerson about a whole host of environmental topics, including 1010 and the vexed question of aviation. He thinks it's wrong for the media to focus on aviation emissions and the environmental damage caused by them.
Airline emissions are about 3% of the global problem. The vast majority of the global problem is associated with power generation, transportation and energy use in residential and agricultural uses. And deforestation. So there is a lot of scope for reducing emissions in those other areas that doesn't exist with airlines. There are no alternative fuels for airlines. Efficiency savings are going to be maybe 10-20% at max. And so if you look at, you know, how much energy is being devoted to the airlines compared to the potential benefit that you're going to get by, you know, people changing to bigger planes or flying a little bit less or something like that, you're seeing a lot of cost for not very much benefit. There are many greater areas where attention can be paid and new ideas tried out that have the potential to have a much greater impact than people flying a little bit less. Now, you know, that might be a little bit self-serving because, you know, like a lot of people, flying is my single largest addition to the carbon footprint. And so, you know, that is obviously not a good thing. But overall, it's not the biggest part of the problem. You know, I think we should be not ignoring these things, but we should be distributing our righteous anger across the spectrum of things where we can make an impact.
Obviously, the big set piece moment for this year politically is Copenhagen, the UN climate talks in December, and you know there's a huge amount of shuttle diplomacy going on and numbers bandied around behind closed doors.
You know, I have communications with scientists all across the world, and we talk about a lot of different things that are going on in the science and, you know, in IPCC and with the next assessment report. Only one or two of these people talk about Copenhagen because it has kind of moved on from the scientists saying, look, we have a problem, to, okay, well, how are we going to go about dealing with that problem? And those are very different kinds of issues. Now, there is this role for science in helping define the policies that are going to help. But the policies aren't really being discussed in Copenhagen. In Copenhagen, we're talking about the timetables and the targets. And those are important, but they also are a little bit, not esoteric, but they're a little bit theoretical. By far the more important point is how you're going to achieve any of those targets. Whether they agree on a 60% cut by 2050 or an 80% cut by 2050, to some extent, that's kind of moot because, you know, just saying that that's your target doesn't make it any closer to happening. The real questions that we have to be discussing, that policymakers need to be discussing, that governments and institutions and individuals need to be discussing, is how are you actually going to get those kind of cuts? You know, what are you going to do about power generation? What are you going to do about transportation? What are you going to do about residential use of energy? There are lots and lots of things that one can do, and there's lots of ideas out there for things, for ways that you could incentivize people to do the right thing at all different levels. But I think the science can help people with that. We can help work out whether, you know, a particular policy is a net benefit to the climate and to air quality maybe and to public health, and look for win-win solutions in all of those different fields, and the science can be very helpful there, but it's not up to the scientists to decide, you know, how the costs and benefits of these things are going to be distributed by the government, and how people who are going to lose out need to be compensated, and how people are going to win can make that happen.
The theme of today's show is the launch of the 1010 movement. What are your thoughts on that as a campaign to kind of get people enthused and engaged and to actually hopefully make a sort of tangible difference?
Well, I think that's great. What we need to combat is this kind of fatalistic attitude that some people I have heard have, which is associated with this idea that there are tipping points in the system and that until we get there, we're okay. And then once we get past it, okay, we're in big trouble. Those kinds of discussions lead people to be complacent at the beginning and then very fatalistic afterwards. And it's a very bad framing for getting people to do the small and achievable things on the way to doing big things. So the 10-10, it's short term, it's small, but it is achievable. And so I think it is something that could give momentum to campaigns to do a much bigger job and more important job down the line by getting people to think, oh, you know, actually it's not so difficult to shave 10% here, 20% there, but it might be something that, you know, kind of prods the government to be more ambitious in the things that they can ask people to do and the things that they can change on a much larger scale.
You can hear all of that interview, by the way, with Gavin in a Science Weekly Extra podcast this week. He talks about whether it's counterproductive to respond to skeptics, and it's there on your iTunes feed right now. It's at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Now, Gavin made some interesting points there on aviation and Copenhagen, as well as 1010, saying it's useful, but the governments actually need to take the lead. To discuss these and give us an international perspective, we've got The Guardian's China environment correspondent, John Watts. John, hello.
Hi.
Tell us, John, what is the situation with China and Copenhagen at the moment? I mean, would a campaign like 1010, which is essentially a domestic UK campaign for everyone here to reduce their emissions by 10%, would it have any impact at all as far away as China?
It would be wonderful if it did, because China is already the world's biggest emitter. But frankly, the truth is it will probably make very little difference to the situation here. The position of China is very, very different. They're at a different stage of the debate about climate change. And the role of individuals is also very different. Perhaps the most revealing way to illustrate this is to say that the average British person has already three times the carbon footprint of the average individual in China, which means that Britons would have to cut their carbon emissions by more than 60% just to get down to the level that Chinese people are already at. And I guess this is not that well understood a lot of the time. There's a lot of talk, rightly, that China is building a coal-fired power station every 5 days and its emissions are rising fast. That's all very true. But the fact is, it's a huge country. It's fast growing. It still has a long way to catch up with Britain and other richer countries. And so people just don't feel the same level of individual responsibility. But saying that, it might help to show that Britain is doing something, and it might persuade some individuals that, yeah, eventually they really need to look at what they're doing and not just rely on the government.
So going to the government sort of level on things, what is the Chinese position going into Copenhagen? What are they, their sort of red lines that they're not going to cross in terms of targets or those things?
At present, China says it should not be obliged to sign up to any binding emissions. Instead, it may be willing to do some voluntary reductions on the speed at which its emissions are growing. That means they won't cap it, for the foreseeable future at least. But what they might try and do is make their economy more efficient. So as they grow, they don't waste as much energy. And that's their main strategy. So what they're likely to offer is some kind of commitment to making their economy more efficient, reducing the amount of carbon that's burned relative to economic growth. And if they really go out on a limb, they might set a date for peaking at some time in the quite distant future, 2030, 2040, possibly even 2050. But the fact is, Chinese emissions are going to probably at least double in the next 20 years, and soon they will be by far the world's biggest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions.
John, is there anything in the way of a kind of environmental movement, a grassroots movement in China of people who are starting to get aware of this issue and are starting to say, well, actually, we need to do more, because even though, because if we do double our emissions over the course of the next 20 years, then that's going to create huge problems? Or is there a sense that culturally things don't really work that way because of the country's sort of communist past, you know, that grassroots movements were just not really encouraged by the state, shall we say?
There definitely is a grassroots movement. And it's growing, and these are very encouraging signs. There's a lot more coverage of environmental issues in the media as well. So it's not just top-down, and that's the good news. At present, though, most of the focus of environmental groups is on the more pressing and tangible problems of the filthy air or contaminated water, and things that affect their health, things that they can feel and touch in their daily lives. Compared to that, climate change seems rather distant. Nonetheless, it has become a much bigger topic, noticeably, in the last 2 or 3 years, and particularly in the last year. So I think things are changing. Although I've lived here now for 6 years, and each time I go back to Britain, I'm always amazed how much more conscious people are back home in the UK of their carbon footprint and reducing emissions and offsetting. And this entire vocabulary does not really exist in China yet. There is a sense that it's somebody else's problem. But I think there is real potential. The area where something like a 10-10 movement could have potential in China can be seen in what happened with the Earth Hour earlier this year. Earth Hour, of course, was something initiated largely by the World Wildlife Fund. It started in, I think it was Sydney, about 3 years ago on a relatively small scale, and it's grown every year since then. And this year, for the first time, there was really significant Chinese involvement with major cities like Hong Kong, of course, but also Shanghai and Baoding, and some famous stars and some famous buildings were turned off. And there was a sense that a lot of people in China want to sign up. They want to show that they can contribute to what is a global effort to try and improve the world we live in. So maybe 10-10 can also set a good example, but I think it would take several years before it can reach that kind of stage.
Okay, John, thanks very much for that. You can leave your thoughts on our Facebook wall or tweet us to your heart's content. Look for Science Weekly or Guardian Science.
Science Weekly.
Well, that's it for this environmentally themed show. My thanks to Franny Armstrong, Gavin Schmidt and The Guardian's James Randerson, Adam Vaughan and John Watts in China. For more information on this, there's everything you want to know at guardian.co.uk/environment or 1010uk.org. And if you hear this in time and are in the area, there's a launch event at London's Tate Modern on the evening of Tuesday, 1st of September. Get down there and sign up to the pledge. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening. By the way, you'll be happy to know that Science Weekly's already signed up to 1010, and as part of the podcast commitment to reducing emissions, we've been recording in the dark.